This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
Good morning. Today on the Law Report, a special feature. Reporter Andrew Dodd takes the pulse of Australia's defamation laws. He explores how the recent introduction of uniform legislation around the country is impacting both on the media and on people who feel that they have been defamed.
Pauline, is this you?
No, Chris, definitely not. Definitely not. No question about it whatsoever. That is not me.
Do you accept that the public looking at this might think, well, there is a resemblance?
Well, yes, I will accept that there is a resemblance, but it's not me. It's definitely not.
Well, it has to rank as one of the low points in Australian journalism. It was the day Sydney's Sunday Telegraph published pictures of a naked model alleging they were Pauline Hanson. As defamation goes, it was blatant, and for a while media lawyers got excited because it looked like it might be a test case for the nation's still relatively new defamation laws. Since the 1st of January 2006, Australia's defamation rules have been uniform, because the Attorneys General got together and all the states and territories enacted basically the same legislation. But the media lawyers have been disappointed. It appears the defamation against Pauline Hanson was so bad that News Limited, the publishers, had no option but to settle. That decision might be a vindication of the new rules, which were designed to help potential plaintiffs, that is, the people who feel they've been defamed, to get redress and a quick apology. Today we'll look at several aspects of the uniform rules and ask whether they're working, whether they've streamlined defamation law, and whether they've reduced the amount of cases going to court.
There's a difference between the various states and territories. I think in Victoria there were very few writs in the first 12 months for defamation, but I'm told that there was very little change in New South Wales, the defamation capital of Australia.
Peter Bartlett is a partner with the Melbourne law firm Minter Ellison and provides most of the defamation advice for The Age and Sunday Age. Defamation can be anything that's published, which means spoken or written, which lowers someone in the estimation of others. If you publish something which holds someone up to hatred, ridicule or contempt, or which leads people to shun or avoid them, or which damages them in their business or trade, you've probably committed defamation. Journalists do it a lot. It's part of their job. They only get away with it because the laws have defences which they can use if the person they've defamed decides to sue them. Under the old rules, there were different defences in each of the states and territories, and loads of differences in the way the rules applied. Each state had its own history. The Queensland and Tasmanian defamation laws could trace their roots to the Indian Penal Code of 1860, while in New South Wales the laws had been codified in legislation but then modified radically. This was a nightmare for the media lawyers, especially those giving pre-publication advice to national broadcasters and publishers.
In those days, we had eight separate jurisdictions with eight separate laws, and so we had to be conscious of what the various laws were in each of those states and territories, and often we would have an article in the hard copy paper, for example, that we didn't send to Western Australia or South Australia or the Northern Territory. And now, more recently, we then didn't put it online because of those restrictions.
And now those restrictions have gone. It is uniform almost entirely. There are some differences, however, in a small degree between some of the jurisdictions.
The variations now are very minor and they don't really affect the pre-publication advice. It's more in the non-defamation areas in pre-publication that you're conscious of the various states and territories. For example, all of the states and territories have different provisions relating to the disclosure of victims of sexual assault.
The new uniform defamation laws differ from the old laws in several ways. The old distinction between libel and slander has disappeared. Plaintiffs can now only sue in one state or territory instead of several at once. Damages or payouts have been reined in, and there are now several new and improved offences and ways in which defamation matters can be headed off before they reach the courts. But for journalists, one of the most exciting changes is that corporations can no longer sue for defamation.
We have over 1 million customers a day in the UK who enjoy coming to McDonald's and trust us.
This is about the public's right to know what the most powerful organisations in the world, which are multinational corporations, are really doing.
Very serious allegations were made about our company.
Do you remember the McLibel case in the UK when the fast food chain McDonald's sued two activists for claiming that the food at Macca's was not nutritious? Well now, thanks to the Uniform Defamation Law, such a case could not happen in Australia. Any for-profit company with more than 10 employees is barred from suing for defamation. And that comes as very good news to Richard Coleman, a former journalist and now the night lawyer for the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian Financial Review.
Often people would sue, they would couple up, they would throw the corporation in with their own action. And now we're not getting sued by corporations. I do think that the newspapers are a little bit freer, particularly finance newspapers like the ones I'm working on, the AFR. I think they are a bit freer in that they don't have to worry about defamation actions from companies. And journalists are still surprised when I tell them. They come in worried about, they're writing about the banks or whatever, and they're still surprised that I tell them that the law has been changed and companies can't sue us for defamation.
Unless that bank has less than 10 full-time employees.
Yes. Well, we've got a battle on our hands over a company that has sued us at the moment, and that issue is being looked at. Companies were never the largest group, but they were part of the largest group of litigants in defamation, I found. The largest group of people to sue us in defamation you could think of as suits, businessmen and women, and large companies. That was the biggest group who sued in defamation. The next biggest group was politicians. The next biggest group after that was lawyers. And the next biggest group after that, strangely enough, was jockeys.
Are you finding that corporations are finding new ways to sue journalists without recourse to the Defamation Act?
No.
So you haven't had the tort of injurious falsehood used against you?
No. And I'm a little surprised there. I thought we would. I'm not trying to encourage it. But no, we haven't. I just think they've been discouraged. They've been told, look, you can't sue in defamation anymore. And they thought, all right, they just have to wear it. And I think it's a much healthier arrangement, I must say. I think that we should be able to more freely discuss the activities of large corporations in particular and the banks without being afraid of getting a writ from them.
Another important change is the damages or the payouts that go to successful plaintiffs have been capped in an effort to reduce the excessive sums paid out by the media to those who sue them for defamation. Peter Bartlett has been doing some calculations comparing payouts under the new laws and the old ones.
I think that that's had a huge effect. You just look in the last 12 months at some of the various judgments that have come. We saw Mark French in Victoria recovering $350,000 against Triple M Melbourne, Lewin Camp in Canberra $375,000 against ACP Magazines, McCartney Snape in New South Wales $448,000, John Coates in New South Wales $360,000. They're all under the pre-Uniform Act. Then since we've had the Uniform Act, there haven't been too many cases decided so far, but Judy Davis recovered $140,000 against Nationwide News, Brett Holmes $70,000 against an MP, Andrew Fraser. So that you can see that there's been a significant trend downwards in the quantum of damages. Now I think the quantum, it's indexed, but it's now approximately $280,000. So that has been a very significant change.
It came in at $250,000 and was capped to CPI, so it's gone up to $280,000 since.
Exactly. It's now approximately $280,000 and is indexed.
What does that mean then that you would have to win to walk out of a defamation case, having made it worth your while if you're a plaintiff?
Well, that's a very good question. The level of costs is very significant. A plaintiff would normally only recover about 70% of their costs from the defendant, and therefore their level of damages needs to be high enough to cover the extra 30% before they even get a dollar in their own pocket.
And that's got to be, by definition, a very serious case of defamation.
That has to be a very serious case of defamation, and it is a very significant reason why the level of actions for defamation has decreased.
What was the reasoning behind this? Was it to try and tie damage to reputation to damage to personal injury so that there was some match between personal injury cases and reputational damage?
There have been some ridiculous decisions in relation to the quantum of damages. We had one case in New South Wales where, I think from memory, the plaintiff recovered about $670,000. The New South Wales Court of Appeal and the High Court said that that was too much and a new trial was ordered. And the new trial, the jury wasn't aware of the first decision and ordered, same set of facts, $1.3 million. And it just shows that the level of damages under the old regime was a lottery.
There is, however, a way in which people are getting around the cap on damages now, and that is by suing several outlets that broadcast or publish the same defamatory material. Theoretically, you could sue Channel 9, you could then sue its website, you could then sue Sky News for the same report. Is that happening, and if so, what effect is that having?
It's still early days, but there have been a couple of interesting decisions. Judy Davis against Nationwide News submitted that she was entitled to two caps, so $280,000 by two as a maximum, on the basis that there were a number of publications. The Supreme Court of New South Wales rejected that and said she was only entitled to one cap. There was a similar decision more recently in Victoria in Buckley against Herald and Weekly Times, where Mr Justice Kay again ordered the consolidation of two separate actions relating to two separate publications and said again that there was only one cap.
But not everyone agrees with this assessment. Clive Evatt, a Sydney-based barrister who represents plaintiffs, says his clients, that is the people who sue the media, are likely to do better under the new defamation rules because juries in New South Wales are no longer involved in the awarding of damages.
One trial is to liability before the jury. One trial before the judge is to damages. Now, this is good because my experience with juries is that although they found for the plaintiff invariably, they were niggardly on damages. And the juries, on average, awarded quite small sums of damages. You're lucky if you ever got 100,000 from a jury. Very often their verdicts were 20,000 or 30,000. And after they'd given their decision, they would come and congratulate the plaintiff and ask him what he thought of the huge amount they've given. Juries aren't good at working out figures for defamation, and therefore the judges, who are much better in awarding damages, they decide damages and will give much higher figures than any jury would.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National. I'm Damien Carrick, and today a special feature by Andrew Dodd on Australia's uniform defamation laws.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth! Son, we live in a world that has walls.
Okay, it's a cheap shot playing an excerpt from the Jack Nicholson movie A Few Good Men, but it does help make a point. Before the introduction of the uniform defamation laws, some states couldn't handle the truth. In other words, when the media was defending itself against defamation, it wasn't enough to prove that what they'd published was true. In Queensland, New South Wales, the ACT and Tasmania, the media also had to prove that there was some public interest or benefit in publishing a defamatory statement. Under the Uniform Code, truth alone is a defence. In Tasmania, this makes a big difference to the advice Daniel Zeman gives his client, the Mercury newspaper in Hobart.
Under the old Act, the 1957 Act in Tasmania, a defence would apply to a particular matter if it was true and it was for the public benefit that the matter was reported. So, in other words, there are two elements to the test. Now, the one element that remains is that the matter is true. That, I think, is of some concern.
Well, talk us through why you think it's a matter of concern.
You have a lot of certain issues that might be true about particular people, and they might think that those issues are relatively private issues, and it's a question of whether or not it's a good thing that those matters, they in some way become newsworthy, can be then trotted out in the media. You lose a lot of rights to privacy in those situations, and my view was always, if you had to show that the matter was true and for the public benefit, that it'd be published, then it's a bit more of a protection for the average person out there in the community. So.
And has this been tested at the Mercury in terms of the pre-publication advice you've given? You're letting through more things now than you would have in the past?
Well, there's no doubt about that. It makes the consideration of that advice easier. The situation you face or used to be faced with is that it was very easy in many cases to determine that for example, something was true, or the advice you were given was true, and that your own consideration of the matter was that it was for the public benefit that it be published, and very easy to put others in the category that it wasn't. There were some grey areas, but that wasn't of any particular concern to me. But now, you turn your mind to the issue of whether or not it's true, the information you're given by the reporter that it's true, and issues of public benefit don't come into it, makes the advice simpler.
So effectively it means it's easier for a newspaper to muckrake?
I wouldn't speak of my client that way, but for the media to muckrake, if I could put it that way, as general as that.
But others say that the introduction of a truth alone defence means very little difference, because under the old rules, anything that the media chose to report on was, by definition, in the public interest, or was at least related to it. Here's Richard Coleman at Fairfax.
If what you were publishing didn't relate to a matter of public interest, then it's probably unlikely that the newspaper would have been interested in publishing a story about it. The newspaper is writing about what relates to a matter of public interest, and there's actually one of those sterile little differences that you get a lot of in defamation law. It wasn't that it was in the public interest, it was that it related to a matter of public interest. I mean, it's quite debatable whether some of these stories were in the public interest, but usually it was fairly easy to prove that what was published related to a matter of public interest.
It's so blatantly obvious that this community is against what's going on. This blatantly obvious woodchip agenda is so transparent, and you guys and the rest of the Tasmanian public know. And we're up against a lot of lies that are coming out about this in the last week, and I'd just like to talk about them now. You might have heard of a bloke called...
This is a recent rally in the Upper Florentine Valley in Tasmania, where the state government is pushing a road deep into the wilderness to let logging trucks in to cut down old-growth forests. At the rally, one of the speakers named a government official and accused him of being a liar.
He is paid to lie.
So the question is, as a reporter, if I go along to a meeting and report what's said, do I have a defence if that official brings an action against me? Well, theoretically, yes. Under the new laws, the media has a defence, but only if it reports what's said fairly and accurately, and only if the meeting is discussing a matter of public interest. Peter Bartlett of Minter Ellison says the media is now using this defence to cover a wide range of meetings.
It is being used, and it's an important potential defence. We did have in the New South Wales Defamation Act a very long schedule of public bodies or tribunals where privilege would apply. But we didn't have that in other states and territories, and in particular in Victoria. There's always been some doubt as, for example, whether a fair and accurate report of the Australian Football League Tribunal would be privileged. I think that that position has now changed.
There's another defence for the media against defamation, and it's become quite controversial. It's known as qualified privilege for the provision of certain information. It's an extension of the famous 1997 Longy case in common law, which confirmed that the media has a defence to defamation when it's discussing certain political matters. The uniform laws have theoretically extended the same right to publish a wide range of material in the public interest, so long as the publication is, quote, reasonable in the circumstances. And that's the problem. Even though the Act gives lots of breaks to the media, the courts, it seems, are very reluctant to side with reporters.
There is a widened privilege defence within the Uniform Act, but it is limited by the requirement for reasonableness. And your listeners would probably take the view, well, that's appropriate. The difficulty for the media is that they need to act reasonably in every relevant area of the publication in the eyes of a judge who looks more at perfection and wanting every I dotted and every T crossed. And I think it really is very difficult for the media to actually succeed on a reasonableness type requirement.
Some people hoped that the new laws, especially the defence of qualified privilege, would do away with defamation action by politicians. But judging by what's been going on in South Australia, it seems that hope is misguided. In separate cases, the Premier has sued the opposition leader, and the Deputy Chief Magistrate has sued the Attorney General. So what's going on? Here's legal commentator Richard Ackland.
In these two cases, yes, as you say, the Premier is suing the Leader of the Opposition, I think, for... It seems like a weird thing. He allegedly defamed the Premier by linking him to a $20,000 donation from a business associated with the Church of Scientology. And the documents that relied on by Mr. Hamilton Smith, who's the Leader of the Opposition in South Australia, and they were a whole lot of emails and invoices and things, were alleged to be fakes. Nonetheless, the opposition leader continued to deny they were fakes, and he made these claims against the Premier, Mr. Rann, outside the Parliament, so Rann's having a go at him. It all seems very... One would think for politicians to be suing, you know, it's a sort of sign of extreme thin-skinned behaviour, but when they've got all the remedies available to themselves inside the Parliament to rectify any hurt to their delicate reputations. The other one was the Deputy Chief Magistrate, I think his name's Dr. Andrew Cannon. He's suing Michael Atkinson, the Attorney General, who called him daft and delusional. And he made those comments after reading one of Dr. Cannon's views on sentencing principles.
Pauline Hanson, apology, take one. On the 15th of March, in the Sunday Telegraph, we published photographs which were said to be of Pauline Hanson. It is clear that the pictures published are not of Pauline Hanson. We made a mistake publishing those pictures. We apologise to Miss Hanson for the hurt and embarrassment caused by the publication. We have learnt a valuable lesson.
That's the wording of the apology published recently by Neil Breen, the editor of the Sunday Telegraph. One of the exciting things about the uniform defamation laws is that apologies are now likely to be given sooner and more freely by the media. In fact, apologies are built into the system so that the media can admit it made a mistake and say sorry without that apology being used against it later in a courtroom. In fact, if a potential plaintiff refuses a reasonable apology, the media can claim that refusal as a defence in an action of defamation. Apologies are part of a new offer to make amends process, a process Richard Coleman says is a big improvement.
Under the new Act, the offer of amends has become a very useful tool. It was designed to help matters settle and to keep defamation matters, if possible, out of the court. And that's a very good object. And it has become useful for the media, particularly when you have a story that's been published that is simply wrong, for whatever reason, that there is a mistake in the story, there's a defamation of somebody. The offer of amends allows the media, gives the media the opportunity to try to resolve the action. And I think that has been very useful. If the plaintiff doesn't accept the offer of amends, which usually consists of an apology, an offer to pay legal costs, plus an offer of money, if the plaintiff rejects that, then the defendant can plead the offer as a full defence to the action. And that puts a lot of pressure on plaintiffs to really look at the offer that's put forward by the media. And if they decide to reject it, then they're taking a risk.
Using the amends process is not the way Clive Evatt likes to fight his cases on behalf of the plaintiffs who sue the media for defamation.
I seldom use that. You don't have to use that. You can just bring a claim for defamation, and if the other side want to settle it, they'll make an offer. Certain media against whom the statement of claim is issued will ring me up and suggest that we settle it, and we negotiate and very often agree. On the other hand, there are other sections of the media who would rather die than settle, and they're still fighting everything. So all is not lost.
So which media outlets are in which camp? Can you reveal that?
Oh, no. I can reveal it, but I won't.
But generally it'd be right to say the big boys are less likely to settle, wouldn't it?
Some of the biggest boys are very keen to settle. I think a lot of it might have to do with the current financial situation. So some of the big names who didn't know the meaning of the word settlement a few years ago have changed solicitors and are settling.
So this is good.
Right from the beginning.
So it's good for you in a sense as a plaintiff lawyer, because you don't have to get to court. You can settle before you get there much more easily under the new act, or not?
No, it's not good at all. Instead of fighting a case and spinning it out for a couple of years, it's settled right at the, they nip it in the bud. I'd prefer to fight them.
I think actually one of the measures of success was doing people like you out of a job, and by that definition, right. I think it's doing pretty well, isn't it?
Well, no, fortunately, there are still a few media representatives who like to fight, so they keep me going.
Barrister Clive Evatt. In summary, it's probably true to say that there haven't been enough cases before the courts to test the really interesting aspects of the new laws. But while the jury's still out, most practitioners agree the Uniform Defamation Act is a pretty big improvement, even though it represents a compromise between the various parties.
The media and plaintiffs' lawyers could not have hoped to achieve everything they wanted to out of the Uniform Act. It is a compromise act that had to get the agreement of attorneys general from 8 states and territories. There were a very large number of submissions on what should be in the Act. It is a compromise act. I think it works well as a compromise act, and I think it's the best that everyone could have hoped for.
Peter Bartlett from Minter Ellison, ending that report on Australia's uniform defamation laws by journalist Andrew Dodd. That's the Law Report for this week. It's now time to find out what's coming up on Life Matters.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.